In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
Families are where we go for love and safety and shelter from storms. What happens when violence corrupts that trust? From SDPB, today is Thursday, August 14th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we talk family safety in South Dakota. We'll check in with two human services nonprofits about trends in funding, rates of violence in our communities, and how South Dakotans are banding together to provide real hope for their neighbors. But we're hoping for more this hour. We're hoping to help serve South Dakota with this show. And by talking about what domestic violence looks like, by talking about the science of hope and pathways to a safer family, we're bringing you conversations that create culture. In this case, we hope a culture of safety. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We are dedicating this hour to family safety in South Dakota. We'll talk about human services for families experiencing domestic violence and the financial pressures local nonprofits are facing to keep those services funded. Now, here's our intention, that not only will we offer an update on critical family safety services, but that you'll also learn more about domestic violence prevention, accountability for people who cause harm in their families, and the science of hope. Let's begin with Children's Home Society of South Dakota. Michelle LaValle is CEO of Children's Home Society. Kate Fellmeyer is Program Director of the Children's Home Shelter for Family Safety in Sioux Falls and Bright Start. We sat down together in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio. This is the oldest social services organization, and it predates statehood.
Isn't that amazing?
Is what you are still running today. Help people understand broadly the elevator pitch, which I know is impossible with your work, but what kind of things that you're doing, and then we'll get into what we're hoping for today.
For the shelter. Mm-hmm. I mean, for Children's Home Society to be 133 years old this year is it kind of extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And the neat thing about it is we were an orphanage, and then in the 60s, you change with society. Society realized that probably wasn't the best thing for kids. So we went in a different direction, and happily it's worked. Yeah. And now we have six different kinds of programs and really helping people, women and kids mostly dealing with trauma, and now families as well. So it, I think, is you want to make sure that you keep it going for another 133 years. So that's what I'm motivated for. And I have to say, I feel so lucky and blessed to be the CEO because I feel like we're the strongest nonprofit human services business in South Dakota.
Yeah. When did the word trauma start coming into your strategic planning? When did we start talking about trauma as mission work?
And it was really, for real, to put it in context, 6 years ago when I came, we really stopped and reevaluated the mission and reevaluated the vision. But they've been talking about trauma for 20 years, really, mm-hmm. and because we were taking kids that were abused and neglected. But the mission is really now to prevent it, to heal trauma, and to treat trauma. So that is really what guides the work. And the vision is to create a world that stands up to trauma so all people are happy, healthy, and resilient. So we know we're not quite there yet, but we're getting there.
Yeah. And Kate, we're spending the hour really talking about family safety is how we're thinking about this in the moment is, you know, what is happening in our community? So tell us a little bit about your work and what you're seeing is happening in our community regarding family safety.
Absolutely. So I'm the director over at Children's Home Shelter for Family Safety, and I'm new into this role. But not new to Children's Home. So still I'm learning a lot, but what we're seeing is we're having an increase in people needing services, service calls, people staying, length of stay becoming longer, and at the same time we're also hearing from law enforcement in Sioux Falls that they're seeing a decrease in numbers. So we turn that to our prevention must be doing really good work because people are coming in before it's too bad or too dangerous. And so we do a lot of prevention work and we're working on expanding that as well.
Yeah. You mentioned, Michelle, the mm-hmm. strength of this nonprofit, and you have led through times of chaos. That's kind of one of your strengths. And I think a lot of people think with federal funding, there's so many organizations across the state who are experiencing uncertainty, delayed funding, canceled funds and grants, and maybe even chaos. Mm-hmm. What are you seeing in that realm, and how are you responding?
Well, Lori, we again feel so blessed that for all these years we've had some strong, strong donors, and that has continued for Children's Home. I'm really happy to say we have a big building going up in Rapid City right now. It's the biggest project that we've ever done, 110,000 square feet that we're redoing to house all of our programs and to really strengthen mental health out there. But Kate is under a circumstance where VOCA funding has been cut. The state had hoped to make up for some of that. We have to wait and see what we get for that. But, you know, we never get paid for what it costs us to deliver care. Mm-hmm. And so we're doing some scenario planning right now that said if we did get a 5% cut or a 10% cut in Medicaid funding, what would that mean for us? And it would mean a lot. 80% of our budget is the people side. So we'd have to immediately cut, like, all the things like any kind of training, any kind of travel. We look at our benefits. We have really done a super job getting our people where they needed to be. 6 years ago, you were making 10 bucks an hour at Children's Home. You're making 20 or 22 bucks an hour in these entry-level jobs because, mm-hmm. honestly, this is because of incredible workforce development funding that we got from Denny Sanford of $45 million. That has changed our trajectory. We had 70% turnover 6 years ago. Now we're down in the 20s. I mean, people can work there for a career rather than leaving and taking a second shift at Walmart. So I do feel so blessed. Part of our mission is that we also take care of the littles, you know, the 4 to 14, and people have a heart for that. Our average age is 8 years old, and it's about 70% boys. But we're also in the adoption business and the foster care business and the shelter business. And I mean, I can see why everybody feels a bit under siege. But we're so lucky to have that plan in front of us that we're going to have a plan that knows exactly what needs to happen if funding cuts happen. For the shelter, we have to fundraise 80% of the $6 million budget every year. So, my goal would be someday if we could permanently endow it, but there's just no funding sources for domestic violence. There's really not state money. There's no per diem for Medicare, for Medicaid. So it's on the backs of donors, and those are the citizens of Sioux Falls, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I want to talk more about that, but first, yeah. Kate, what you talked about, prevention. What are some of the prevention efforts that you think are effective and are helping move the needle?
Yeah. So our first line is that we have a 24/7, 365 crisis line. So anybody can call anytime, and they can come in anytime. So it doesn't matter if it's 3 a.m., a weekend, holiday, you can get help. So people can reach out. But also we have a court advocate who's going to court with people for protection orders, which can be very scary because mm-hmm. you're facing the person who hurt you.
30 a week in Minnehaha County. I was shocked at that, Kate.
Yes.
So we go with them.
30 times per week in Minnehaha County to help someone navigate the protection order process.
Yeah, that's how many typically are about on the docket every week just in Minnehaha County. And then we go to Lincoln County as well, and then our other three service areas as needed. But our outreach advocate goes and comes alongside people, helps them prepare for what they need to have in order for it to move forward. And so that is a big prevention line because that's one phone call. If a person has a protection order, they can call and law enforcement can intervene. A lot of times they can't otherwise. Yeah. So that's a huge prevention. And then we're also in getting into schools. So we go to middle school and high schools and talk about healthy versus unhealthy relationships, how to navigate that if you find yourself in that situation, but also if someone like a friend is experiencing it and how you can get them help. Because sometimes people aren't very receptive to that, so it can be really hard at that age to do that.
Yeah. Back to the philanthropy aspect of this, Michelle. How do you, the role of philanthropy in South Dakota, because we are all asking big questions about whose responsibility yeah. is to fund it. Mm-hmm. Some people think this should come, you know, certain funding mm-hmm. should come from the federal government, certain funding should come from the state. That's the state's responsibility. Mm-hmm. And then there's all of us.
Yeah.
And we are the $5 donors to the, you know, $50,000 donors who are showing up to support the nonprofits in our communities in cities like Sioux Falls and Rapid, but really across South Dakota in the smallest towns with the smallest nonprofits. Can't backfill federal funding.
Exactly.
With our own donations, no matter how much the tax cut is, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the part that's scariest the most. Like a couple of years ago, we spent a lot of time in the legislature, and we got a 41% increase because we hadn't had a true increase for 6 years. And that was amazing. That was a game changer. That was another $4 million we added to our budget. Yeah. So, and that's for kids that are in the custody of the state. They've been removed from their home for abuse and neglect. So we really made the point, should donors really fund a kiddo that's in the custody of the state and they're trusting us? So that, I think we made a really good point there. And all of us in this business that are relying on Medicaid dollars got those. But now we're 2 years in. And so each year you have to plan on, because they only rebase you every 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I know we talked about Linda Duba, and I mean, that was one of their big issues. And Gene Hunhoff, you know, nobody has to fundraise for up to 25% of your kiddos. That has to come from state dollars. And it did. I have to say that was one of the most successful things we've done in the last 6 years, is get that base where it needed to be. And, you know, that's also why we can pay people better. And, you know, it came to kind of a crisis when some folks said, our kids are here longer than our staff. You can't have that, because the kids have been deserted by so many other people, and ours is a safe place. Mm-hmm. And so we want them to feel like we're walking the path with them, right? And 90% of our kids leave and either go back home or go into a safe foster care situation, which I'm so grateful for.
Yeah.
But we need more foster homes too. But we got to pay them what it's worth.
Right. Yeah. That's
$100 a day is pretty tough to do, to take in a foster kid.
Yeah. Kate, for people who are listening and are saying, hey, you know, what is a safe relationship? What are some of these things that, and we're going to talk more in depth about what intimate partner violence is a little bit later in the hour, so we don't have to go super into it. But for young people, for a middle school student, for a high school student who's maybe in a relationship for the first time, what are some key things that you're looking for, especially regarding like control and power dynamics in relationships?
Absolutely. And you hit it nail on the head with control and power is what abuse is about. And so it's, if you're in a relationship with someone and they're starting to control who you're around, when you can be on your phone, your job, your money, those are all huge red flags. Another one is like kind of the whirlwind romance. So if it's just out of the world, incredible, really fast, a lot of times we see that, and it's called the honeymoon period. Mm-hmm. And then that's when the abuse begins to come into play. And then usually there's a big event. And then there's a honeymoon period, and that just keeps going in a cycle. So if something doesn't feel right, or you feel like you're losing control of yourself and the things that are important to you, that's probably a red flag that you should maybe talk to somebody.
Yeah. What are some of the things that you're hearing from people who come to the family shelter that drove them there? Not drove them in a car, but like made them make that choice to say, this is it. Like, I'm going to the emergency room right now. I'm going to a shelter.
It varies from loved ones who reach out first and say, hey, my daughter, my friend, my sister is in this situation. I don't know what to do because she doesn't see it or he doesn't see it. And so that it can be from somebody encouraging them, like family, friends, or law enforcement, or they've just had a situation where it wasn't safe, and so they leave in that moment. And since we're there all the time, they come in that moment. And it takes an average of 7 times for people to fully leave an abusive situation. So someone might leave on the first time or the second time, someone it might take 12, but the average is 7. So it's usually feeling the waters first time. Mm-hmm. They come in, make sure we're a trusting place, and that we can be somewhere that is safe.
Yeah. Why are you safe? What makes you safe?
Absolutely. All of our advocates are very well trained in trauma. We're all trauma-based relational intervention trained. And then we do hope as a science is very important to us. And hope is the number one outcome. Like, if somebody has hope, we can fuel that for them and give them more pathways to get where they want to succeed. And so our staff are very passionate about that, and we're a locked facility. We have cameras. Law enforcement is great at responding if we need them, but we're a very locked down, secure facility. We've had law enforcement say, I think you're the safest building in the state. So we're pretty safe physically, but also we're very open and welcoming to all. So we serve everybody in shelter, which a lot of people don't know that we do serve men. So yeah. Right along together, men and women, children. So we serve from birth to all the way.
This might be the first time mm-hmm. someone who enters your facility has felt safe, or the first time they felt safe in a long, long time. What's happening physically to you once you come into a safe space and start to allow yourself to relax into that?
Yeah, a lot of people are surprised by our shelter. It's not a big room with a bunch of bunk beds. It's very much built like a home. Trauma-informed care was really considered in the design. And so there's a lot of natural light. There's private bedrooms and private bathrooms. There's meals served. So people a lot of times come in and are surprised. And then sometimes people just sleep. Because if you've been in fight or flight for days, months, years, finally being in a safe spot where you can sleep, we let them just sleep because that's what their body needs in that moment.
Yeah. Why is this work important to you personally?
I got into this work because I grew up in a home with domestic violence, and I wanted to be that change and that hope for somebody to get out.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is personal. And a lot of our folks, mm-hmm. it's personal to them. We just left the shelter when we had everybody serving. We were just doing our picnic. And everybody has a story. And, you know, they're willing to share their story. Yeah. Our shelter employees, out of 380 employees, have some of the highest employee engagement and satisfaction scores. And I think it's because they are there and they have a purpose. Mm-hmm. And I think they know how to cope with that. It's kind of like being in the ER a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think I call them adrenaline junkies. But it's really, they come in, they assess it, and they can take it, and they can quickly get to work.
Yeah, yeah.
Or she mentioned something that I just am, if you don't mind me talking about the science of hope. We realized all these programs didn't have one common denominator, and they're all pretty different. So we got all the directors together and researched what could be a platform, a treatment protocol, and we settled on the science of hope out of the University of Oklahoma. Huh. They have an amazing story. There's 2,000 journal articles written that hope is the biggest predictor of resilience and well-being, especially after trauma. And he's proven it time and time again. He's got hope camps, got a great book. So our whole organization got trained in it. And I love to tell the story because Kate's doing it. We measure that person's hope when they come in. And what do you think their hope is the first day they get to the shelter on intake?
It's not good.
It's 10 quick questions.
Yeah.
And then what do? They make a plan. That's what the science of hope is. Establish goals and establish a pathway and keep giving them the willpower to do it. And it's naturally what you do. Like, mm-hmm. what are the steps for a woman with her case manager? Or we have 3 therapists too, Lori. That's unusual in a shelter. They can have as much therapy. Their kids can have therapy. And even after they leave the shelter, they can have therapy. But that's one of those things that we'd have to cut. Those are the things that are the icing on the cake. But it makes a huge difference. How do you go through the plan?
The therapy is so important because there's usually like backstory. I know this is a little off, but there's usually more to than just the situation, so they can dive all the way back and really help people heal.
Yeah.
And so it would be devastating to lose that part of our program. But everybody gets a case manager. Everything in our shelter is optional. So nobody's required to do case management if someone comes in and they say, no, thank you, I've got this on my own. We just let them know, if you change your mind, we're here. Mm-hmm. And this is how we can help. But they meet with their case manager, and they go through everything from what barriers do they have. Maybe they have an eviction on their record. That's not uncommon to have happen, that the person they're fleeing has caused them to be evicted before.
Right.
And so how we can overcome that. And so each barrier also has to have a pathway for how we can break that down. Maybe they have a landlord that they owe $4,000 to. They're not going to be able to rent until we've navigated that with them and set up a payment plan. So it's every step of the way breaking it down. Yes, I want housing, but to get there, I have to manage this situation, legal situation, or this financial situation. And so we give them a path to each one of those and at the speed they want. So some people, you can give them a list of 10 things to do, and they'll do that. Some people, they're still living in crisis. They're also coming out of something very traumatic. So they might be one at a time. I finished this step, give me the next one. And so we can break it down to however level they need.
And when they leave, what happens? What do you think their hope score is?
It definitely has risen.
So that's, big smile.
Truthfully, that's what I want to talk about, is that all of our programs are measuring hope. So are employees. Because you have to have hope yourself to give it.
Evidence-based.
It's evidence-based. Yeah. I mean, I'm actually like kind of a nerd about this because we're also having
a hope nerd.
I'm a hope nerd. Because guess what? I have really high hope.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of it, I think, is just the way you're wired and it's resilience. But it's also coming from a background of branding and marketing because you're pitching ideas all the time. And if you don't like that one, I got 10 more in my back pocket. And that's what we ask our kids. When you're faced with something hard, can you find a lot of other ways to get through that? So we just did all of our kids on the Sioux Falls campus, 96 kids. And I was so happy. None of them had zero hope. And these are people living in residential treatment.
Right.
I think 19% had high hope. And then there was middle and moderate hope. And what we want to say, and I want to say to funders, don't you want to give to places where you know that their hope is rising and that's a predictor of their resilience and their success? We're doing it with our board, too. Oh, my God. The guy that's teaching us this professor, and Chan Hellman at the University of Oklahoma, I said, our board should take it, too. If you're governing an organization like
this,
we want high hope. We want rising hope. So we're going to have, like, a scorecard for each of our programs. How do they do quarter after quarter? Are we rising hope? And we can do it by age, by location, by type of program, by therapist. I mean, if we find a therapist that's got super, all the people under that therapist care, they all have high hope. What does that tell us?
Right.
That something really good is happening.
Something good is happening there.
I know. I'm so excited about this. Mm-hmm. So we're hope inspirers.
That's Michelle LaValle and Kate Fellmeyer of Children's Home Society. LaValle is CEO and Fellmeyer is program director for Family Safety Shelter in Sioux Falls. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're spending the hour today talking about family safety in South Dakota. Krista Herron-Graber is executive director of the South Dakota Network Against Family Violence and Sexual Assault. The nonprofit agency seeks to support survivors of domestic violence. That includes legal help, access to resources, and statewide training for partner organizations. She joined me in SDPB Sioux Falls studios. We're going to let listeners know that we might be talking about some difficult stuff, but it's really important stuff and also can be very empowering if you're listening and maybe you have survived something or broken a cycle of violence or are finding a resource that can help you make the future better than the past. So it can be hard to listen to, but it can also be uplifting in some ways. Tell me a little bit about how you got into this work.
When I graduated from undergraduate school many, many, many years ago, it was my first job was at Children's Inn in Sioux Falls, which is now called the Shelter for Family Safety. And I started to work with people that were staying in shelter and coming for services and have stayed in the work now for 38 years, actually. I just found it to be very, very important. And I was very surprised at the number of victims and survivors of violence that we come in contact with every day in our communities in South Dakota.
Yeah. Do you work across the state? Do you work in Sioux Falls? What's your reach of your organization?
Our organization is statewide.
Okay.
We have an office in Sioux Falls, also one in Rapid City. We have a staff person who works out of their home base in Pierre. And we travel the state a lot and are absolutely statewide, yes.
Yeah. So you've seen a lot of trends as well. You've seen a lot of things change. Are there things that you look back at the beginning of your career that have been addressed through policy and you feel like, oh, we've made some improvements in this area, but then in other areas it feels like we've really lost ground? Or is this a you know, kind of a consistent, like this is a societal problem that we're always going to be dealing with? And only in different ways with different best practices.
It's definitely a societal problem that I believe that there's been more research and evidence-based practices that are bringing us to a space that we're able to understand the risk and lethality of intimate partner violence and violence and abuse that occurs. to families. That probably wasn't as present when I started many years ago. There also wasn't a huge focus on offender treatment, and there's more understanding that offenders also need to have the appropriate type of treatment to make change for the families. So there's been more services that have been created. I think the services are trauma-informed.
Yeah.
We didn't really talk about trauma when I started out many years ago. So that has been an improvement. Legislatively, there's been quite a few laws that have passed in the South Dakota legislature that's been very helpful to protect victims and hold offenders accountable. But the funding the last few years has become a huge struggle and continues to be a struggle because we don't know what the future looks like for victim services funding in South Dakota.
So what kind of services do you provide?
So the South Dakota Network is a statewide coalition.
Okay.
As a statewide coalition addressing sexual assault, domestic violence, and violence through the lifespan, we provide training, technical assistance, consultation, social policy work. Mm-hmm. We do so to help those direct services providers across the state of South Dakota that are providing services to families, victims, survivors, and also offenders. The network, our primary focus is not direct services, even though we do some direct services because we're in contact with survivors and, all the time. But we're really working on how can we help victim services, offender treatment, how can we improve that in our state? How can we help families be safe? What do we need to do to make sure that the shelters, crisis centers, and other services are staying open?
Help me understand if we have data on how big the problem is of intimate partner violence or domestic violence, or like how do we measure or do we measure how big the problem is in South Dakota?
So the number of individuals that have been served by victim services agencies through the Department of Public Safety Victim Services, that number over the years has stayed quite consistent, around 15,000, 16,000. The last few years it has looked pretty consistent of the number that have been served. Otherwise, we can look at some of the crime information that is reported. Our crime data isn't always as consistent because there's different reports that need to be, the federal report, the state report.
Sure.
Some of it is optional. And so there's been some changes in the crime data. I think it overall has looked pretty consistent that we have consistently seen sexual assault crimes and intimate partner violence. I can say, though, because I've done this work for 38 years, that there does seem to be more and more homicides, and the level of violence has really appeared to increase. And since I testify in court as an expert witness often, I have testified in more homicide trials in the last 2 years than I have my entire career.
Really? I want to start with how you mentioned being in court, which means you have to prove, something. But just believing somebody in the beginning, if someone tells you there's a problem or you want to ask somebody if there's a problem, what's the role of us listening to each other and believing what somebody says, no matter who they are?
Well, it's very important to believe when someone is sharing with you something that's occurring in their life, because it takes a lot of courage and strength for a survivor or victim to be able to reach out for help. And if you don't believe them or they have a really poor response, that could really shut them down.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it really is an honor that they've come to you to share this with you because they see you as someone they can trust, a safe person that will be able to hopefully provide assistance if that's what they need. Yeah. But listening and believing is very, very important.
Yeah. How many cases probably go unreported? That's hard to measure. I saw some studies that were saying like only 3% of cases probably get reported, but I don't know what the methodology for that is. So what do you have, what kind of sense do you have of how many people actually come forward?
Well, I think that there are quite a few people that report maybe to family and friends eventually, okay, or to services. But as far as reporting to law enforcement or the utilizing the criminal justice system, there's less, I think, that are able to do that for a variety of reasons. Yeah. And for a victim survivor, looking for justice isn't always a criminal justice system. They're trying to find some way to move on with their healing and find some justice. And so it really is up to them if they're wanting to report to, you know, the authorities and to law enforcement. But we would always strongly encourage that they go to someone who's safe and hopefully find services that are going to help them with their healing journey and find safety.
What are some of the early warning signs that you might see that this is a relationship that might turn violent? What are you looking for in a new relationship or in a relationship that's facing a stressor and is taking a turn?
So what we understand about intimate partner violence, family violence, is that it's based in power and control. And so sometimes the relationships start out absolutely amazing, and this is the best person in the whole world that they've ever met. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the case, and there's not going to be any concerns. But if they start to notice some red flags, such as it could be the person starts to monitor where they go and who they talk to and send them so many text messages, they're really checking it up on them instead of, they love me so much, they want to know what's going on with me. Or they start to encourage that they make changes in their life that they don't really want to make. Mm. You know, maybe changes to their family and friends or how they look or how they dress. But really slowly start to kind of take control of their life. Mm. And then sometimes what you can find also are some boundary issues that, even though you've been in a relationship for a short period of time and there's just a lot of feelings, this is a great relationship, but it's moving really, really quickly. Mm. And there is maybe some concerns about the questions and the things that are occurring that are happening way too fast. Just, you know, that would be something to just take a breath and be a little cautious. Any time that it turns into any type of physical or threats of physical or even indirect comments about violence and abuse, there is absolutely a reason to be concerned that this will continue.
And some people might want to wait it out, or there might be an incident of violence and the perpetrator says, oh, I mean, things just really got carried away. It'll never happen again. We hear this story again and again because it's a common pattern.
It is a common pattern.
Is there a way to interrupt the cycle of violence within a relationship if someone is accountable to it? Like what? Because somebody may say, I might want to save this relationship, but not with this component of it. How hard is that to do? And what kind of commitment does it take from all parties?
Well, the commitment to make the change needs to really come from the person who's causing harm. Okay. They're the only one who should be accountable because they're choosing to cause the harm. Someone else, the victim often, or victims get blamed for that abuse that's occurring. Mm-hmm. But the person who's causing harm is the only one who's accountable. And so accountability is very, very important for that person who's causing harm to understand they're the only one who's responsible. They're the one who needs to get help. they need to go through treatment to continue to work on their power and control issues in this relationship. It really isn't up to the other family members to fix it. It's not their responsibility. They won't be successful if they try to fix it, unfortunately, because it really is up to that person that needs to address the harm they're causing.
Go back and listen to that again. If you're listening on your device, it's so easy to slip into blaming or pulling the victim of a crime into the problem solving. Why is that? Is that just so deep in our culture? What's happening there?
Well, I think if you haven't been a part of an intimate partner violent relationship or even, you know, family, you know, that you've had those experiences, it's hard to understand it, to understand what's happening. And so there is kind of a tendency to blame others for many things.
Mm-hmm.
And not understanding, for some reason, we jump right to blaming the victim. Well, why don't you just leave? You must like it. Why are you staying? Why are we not asking the question, why is the person causing the harm that's causing the harm? Why is this person that is hurting the family breaking the law? Because that's what they're doing. We don't ask those questions. And it is interesting why that is. I would guess it may be because we don't understand, or we don't want to believe that it's occurring, because it occurs so often in our society that it's hard to believe that this is happening so often. So I don't know if I know the answer to that, but I really hope that the listeners stop and think the next time they question why the victim is staying. They need to ask the question why the person that's harming the family is doing that.
We had an interview with some musicians who played at the Lovett across the street here, played in a band called Sister Sadie, and they had a song, and the fiddle player was talking about the abuse that she experienced at the hands of her father and this breaking of a cycle. Like, I broke the cycle and did not pass this on. And they have a beautiful song about that. And she talked about the number of people who come up to her after a show and say, this spoke to me for these reasons. And one woman who came up and said, I am the person who has done harm to my son, and this song meant a lot to me because of breaking the cycle. He won't talk to me about this anymore, but I am fully accountable. So let's talk about the people who do harm and how they get help, because accountability is really difficult. And also, where do you turn if you're the person with the power and control issues? Because that is not a fun thing to look at in the mirror.
Absolutely. I would agree. It's very difficult for people that are causing harm to take responsibility and accountability for their actions. And so I think that's the message.
Yeah.
Stop denying and blaming others and take responsibility that you're harming others with your actions and your behavior. And if that is the case, then it's important that they go to a counselor. There are different groups that are available through Lutheran Social Services in Sioux Falls for people that, you know, cause harm in relationships. That's a resource that they could reach out to. But it's really important to start seeking services. They can always call 211 to find out what resources would be available to assist them. If drug and alcohol or addiction is a part of the challenges they're facing, of course they should seek help for their addiction, but also keep in mind that drugs and alcohol, that addiction is not causing the violence. So even if they're addressing the addiction issues, they also need to address why they're causing harm to their family or to their loved ones. They're really handled as two separate issues.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because, obviously, not everyone who drinks or uses drugs is violent. Mm-hmm. So we can't say that it's a causation for the intimate partner violence that may be occurring.
There's more to this conversation. It's coming up just after a quick break. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to return now to my conversation with Krista Heron-Graber. She is Executive Director of the South Dakota Network Against Family Violence and Sexual Assault. We're talking about family safety today, and there is a funding crisis. Let's start there.
So we had some major challenges that really started in like 2021, 2022, with some changes that Congress had made a few years prior than that with the Victims of Crime dollars. They had rerouted the money into, I believe, it was a different fund. And so the Victims of Crime dollars, which had been a very large amount of money that had gone to victim services in South Dakota, was slowly dwindling from like $10 million to eventually now it's in the $3 to $4 million range. It was a very huge drop that was occurring, and there wasn't other funding to fill that. So that was and has continued to be some of the largest challenges. Our agency, in collaboration with others, we were able to go to the state legislature, and the state legislature provided the first year $8.3 million for victim services, which was distributed over a two-year period of time. And then we've gone back two more times to get more one-time funding of $5 million each year, last year and the year before, for victim services in South Dakota, because that fund, even though it's been fixed, Biden and our congressional delegation completely supported the fix. It was called the VOCA fix. It was fixed in 2021. The fund is not filling up as quickly as they hoped for victim services funding. Hmm. So the level is not where it needs to be again to be distributed to victim services in South Dakota, and this is impacting the entire country. So we hope every year that the legislature will find a revenue source that's going to be an ongoing fund to address victim services in South Dakota. It's important to note that there have been some agencies. One, Vermilion Domestic Violence Safe Option Services, they actually closed their doors this year. There have been other agencies that have been close to closing their doors. It has been a huge struggle. The legislature has kept those doors open, and that's for victims and survivors and their families. That's all about making South Dakota a safe place for everyone. So we hope that the legislature will continue to prioritize our state or our victim services and our state and find an ongoing revenue source. So that's going to provide more stabilization for the funding that we need to provide shelters, crisis centers, and many other services for families in South Dakota.
Is that tied to pandemic at all? Did you see other trends that emerge from the pandemic? Do you think that the financial challenge was connected to the pandemic, or was that something that was happening parallel to it?
It was happening parallel to it.
Are there other trends that you saw during the pandemic and as we come out 5 years later to say, yeah, we noticed this, this is a trend that we saw? We heard you say, okay, so the funding, as far as trends and, you know, what we're looking at, funding is an increased challenge. Violence is in the level of violence in the homes is to the point of homicide is increasing in your personal experience. Other trends that you're seeing?
During the pandemic, there were some entities or agencies in South Dakota that were definitely reporting that there was an increase in domestic violence, intimate partner violence. And I think that some of the statistics that I saw that were South Dakota specific definitely showed an increase in intimate partner violence. Maybe that was because families were home together more than they were usually home together. But I don't know that there were other trends that were specific.
Yeah. There was a lot of stress and job loss at that time as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have also noticed, and I think This may be a trend, but definitely from my personal experience, there does seem to be more and more victims and survivors that are fighting back. And so, you know, a victim that's in a domestic violence, intimate partner violence situation, relationship, really has three choices. They can stay, submit to the violence. They can leave or they can fight back. And I have noticed, and I think others have noticed, that there are more and more people that are fighting back. I don't know if that's because our society is becoming more violent, or is it maybe they don't trust that the criminal justice system will be able to help them? You know, I don't know the answer to that. Maybe that is a question to ask each person when they are making that choice to fight back. But my understanding is when they are fighting back, they're doing so because they are trying to survive.
Talk a little bit about training law enforcement officers or healthcare providers or other service providers to notice the signs of domestic or intimate partner violence and help people find a better future, whether that be accountability for causing harm or removing yourself and somehow escaping and creating life without the person who is causing harm.
Yes, absolutely. So law enforcement receive training every 4 years, and then of course as new recruits in domestic violence, our agency is a part of providing a training team to provide that training. We recognize these are really difficult calls that they're called on because they're in danger too when they're responding.
Yeah.
And so we really want to continue to support training because they are also crimes that are very different than other crimes. Intimate partner violence involves high emotion within the families, and it's not like I'm reporting that a stranger stole my car as compared to I'm reporting that my family that I love is harming me. So there's a lot of differences in these types of crimes that endanger the lives of everyone involved, including law enforcement. Training is so critical to recognize with medical professionals, law enforcement, others, the signs of intimate partner violence. Many that we talked about today, look for coercive controlling behavior. Obviously look for physical violence, sexual violence, one of the last things they'll talk about, the cycle of violence and patterns. But if you think that there could be intimate partner violence happening, it's really important to attempt to make some type of intervention for the safety of the family and to help the offender, but also to find safety for the victim or the victims. If someone is listening and finds themselves in a situation like that, and this they're relating to the things that I'm saying, please reach out for help. Call someone for help. Do so in a safe manner. There's many shelters and crisis centers. Like I said, you can call 211. Talk to a safe family member or friend, but you don't need to live in a situation where you're in danger. Absolutely not. And you're not to blame for it. The person who's causing the harm needs to get help. It is important to get help. This isn't normal behavior. For so many people, it's become a more normal part of their life, normal part of their family. It doesn't have to be. It really doesn't have to be. You have a right to be safe, especially in your own home.
That is Krista Herron-Graber with the South Dakota Network Against Family Violence and Sexual Assault. She is the network's executive director. For connection with services, you can call the Helpline Center at 211. And that's our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngerman and Ellen Kester. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.